All right. In the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen.
O Heavenly King, the Comforter of the Spirit of Truth, who art ever and fills all things, treasure of blessings and giver of life, come and abide in us and cleanse us from every impurity and save our souls with goodwill. In the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen.
All right. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
How are we doing? No, not doing that again. How's this side? No, we're not doing that again. Okay. So in continuing on with our series, as you guys have noticed over the last few weeks, things have been a little different with our classes, right? Obviously, we have the Wednesday class. Please come to that if you're not already coming. We've still been doing our Sunday class with Anthony teaching and so on. But we've changed it up a little bit where we're having other people speak, particularly myself and Deacon Vasily. And one of the other things you might have noticed with our classes have changed a little bit is we're starting to center them a little bit more towards catechism for the next few weeks. And then once we finish that up, we're going to go back to the way we're more with Anthony with his stuff. We may jump in and do classes from time to time on Sundays like that. But we wanted to give an overarching sort of fuller catechism that we could tailor down, right? Because I know some of you just really love reading that 330-page, PDF file, right? So we're trying to tailor that down, tailor down the classes a little bit, and keep the focus on coming to church. Because that's ultimately the most important thing, right? Is come to church, come to liturgy, come to Vespers, come to Wednesday, to the Malevian that we do before church, right? Especially because I get some of you guys involved and you never get a chance to read until you're, later on. So it's one of the things you definitely want to do. That being said, in that series of talks, one of the things that we did the iconostasis a couple of weeks ago, and Anthony's been doing all the other classes in regards to theosis, baptism, what all that means, and so on, and he'll continue to do that. But one of the things that oftentimes I like to talk about, and I do with catechumens and adults, those who have been in church their entire lives, is I like to talk about how the church administratively works. That's a thing that a lot of people don't really understand. They see, especially, that's not getting against our parish here, right? But this parish here hasn't been visited by a bishop in years because of all the changes and everything like that and distances and stuff like that. So sometimes people lose focus on what even a bishop is. Or why is there a priest and why is there a deacon? And what's the difference between him and me? And so those are things we talk about in these classes. But in particular, I want to talk about that a little bit. But I also want to talk about the church's administrative side. And sort of give you guys an understanding of how that all works structurally speaking, in particular because, many of you come into this church and you go, what's the difference between you and St. Paul's in downtown? And I go, we have different bishops. We answer to different bishops. And you go, what do you mean you answer to bishops? How can you answer to a different bishop? Don't you, if you're Orthodox, don't you all have the same bishop? And the answer is technically no. And the reason we're going to talk about that briefly. But the first thing I want to talk about is to give the general overview, as I said, sort of like the mini version in the main talk in this sense is you notice in the hierarchy of the church, there's a few things that I want to point out with regards to the hierarchy of the church. Now, before I do that, does anybody know what the hierarchy of the church actually is? And we're talking about the levels of clergy, not metropolitan archbishops and titles. I'm talking about actual hierarchy of the church. Does anybody know? Anyone raise your hand? Don't all jump in at once. Chad.
Doesn't it just go leaders, subdeacon, deacon, priest, and then bishop?
Yeah. So it goes reader, subdeacon, deacon, priest, bishop. That's absolutely correct. Right? That's all the various different orders of the clergy. They all represent different things within the church. Now, there's something that oftentimes gets missed, and you're going to see this in January when Bishop Gerasim comes to visit, is you'll notice this when you hear this in liturgy particularly, but there's something that often gets misunderstood with liturgy, which is the church assumes, it has a sort of weird assumption thing and that everything is present at all times. And what do I mean by that? Everything is present at all times. It assumes you have everybody present for various different services. Every divine liturgy assumes that you have readers, subdeacons, deacons, priests, and a bishop. Which is why you might notice that Deacon Vasily always says, Master Bless to me. I'm not a bishop, yet he always says, Master Bless. Right? Because it assumes that the bishop is he serving with the bishop. Well, when I serve by myself without him, you never hear that. right? Because I don't have to ask for a blessing from, unless the bishop's here, of course I ask for a blessing, but I don't have to ask for a blessing during services because I'm the one giving the blessings, right? That's part of my office, part of my job, so to speak. Whereas the deacon, because he's under that level of the hierarchy, because he's under that level, he has to do that. He has to treat it as though the bishop is present. And just like that, hold on one second, Anthony. Just like that, right, the subdeacons, they will go up and they will ask when they get a blessing with their robes. They have the arari. You notice Alex wears the arari. He's a blessed subdeacon. He's not actually a subdeacon, but he's blessed to wear the arari. When he goes, he gets the same type of blessing. When he gets his vestment blessed out of deacon wood, where the deacon gets his arari and cuffs blessed, then he goes up and he says, Master, blessed too. Because he's again assuming that there's a bishop present. The church assumes a lot of things. The divine liturgy itself assumes all of this. Vespers assumes all of this. Every service of the church assumes everybody's present, which is why you'll hear during services things like where I'll say, you know, peace be unto you, reader, right? I'll, you know, when the person out there is reading, I'm saying peace be unto you, reader. I say when it's someone who's not a reader, I say blessed to who reads. That's a personal thing. I've heard other priests do that, so I do it too, right? But some priests will say blessed to reader, whoever, regardless if the person's a reader or not. And the only reason I do that is because we have women read in church, and that'd be weird to call a woman a reader, right? Because we don't ordain women to be in readers, regardless of what other jurisdictions might do, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But as you hear throughout the services and you're paying attention to the services, you're noticing things in the services that, again, assume a lot of things. And assume that you've got all things present. Come on, buddy. You can come on in. I'm getting to the bad part right now. No, I'm just kidding. All right, now James is going to take over the class, and he's going to tell us all about what was he telling you about earlier? Oh, why there was a different cross in church? Because I just switch them out. That's all. It's a good question, actually. Probably the best question I've been asked all day. I like kids' questions. Kids always ask me the best questions. I know I'm getting on a tangent, but I get the funniest questions. I love like when Wyatt gives me questions. Because he'll ask me questions like, why is your cassock gray instead of black? I like black. Because I wear the gray one today. But I like the black one. Okay, thank you, Wyatt. You're awesome, kid. Yeah, I love kids. They're great. You know? Anyway, but back to what I was saying is, again, church assumes all these things are present. Throughout the services, they assume all things are present. Okay? And when they assume all things are present in the services, that's why you hear things being done in that manner, because the church assumes every single time you serve the divine liturgy, for example, you're serving hierarchical divine liturgy, even though you're not serving the hierarchical divine liturgy. And the hierarchical divine liturgy is the liturgy that is with the bishop present and all that kind of stuff. And as you guys are going to see in a couple months' time, that's actually half done out here and half done in there. So the bishop gets vested out here, and there's a whole thing about it. That's going to be really cool for you all to see that, because you've never seen that. Some of you have never seen that before. But before I digress too much, because I want to get to the more meat of the other topic with regards to church jurisdiction and stuff like that. On the flip side of that, with the hierarchy of the services, that hierarchy is also practiced within the government side of the church, the legislation side of the church, if you will, the administrative side of the church. And in that, the church itself has various different roles for each different position in the as well outside of that too. A reader and a subdeacon are considered minor clergy orders. They're part of the clergy. That's why when you will hear, like, well, we should be ordaining two new, you know, we should be ordaining Ron and Tahir to readers when the bishop's here, God willing, that I don't call it a tonsure, although you'll hear others say they're being tonsured. No, it's an ordination. In the prayer service, you'll hear it. It'll say this is the first step to the priesthood. Every priest who's ever been ordained a priest, every deacon, every bishop has been at one of those levels. So, he's over there. So, the reader and the subdeacon are orders in the church. They're minor orders in the church. They serve primarily just a liturgical function. That's really all they're really there for, is to serve a liturgical function. Whereas the deacon, the priest, and the bishop, their role expands out. It goes to a completely different level of things where there's a little bit more responsibility put on them. Liturgically speaking, the deacon now has mostly a liturgical role. But in this parish, Deacon Vasily is like my assistant priest. That's the way I like to see him as. You know, he helps. He does a lot for this parish, right? He's not just there to just serve liturgy, you know, kind of thing. He's there to do more. That's part of his role. Historically speaking, that was the case. It changed over the years. I think that that should be a role that should be enacted more where the deacon has that role. But back to my point is that in those other orders, which are called the major clergy orders, the deacon, the priest, and the bishop, all of them have more set administrative outside of the liturgy roles, right? I am the rector of this parish, which means I am the one who is, as a priest, I am the one who's in charge of this parish and such like that. I've been assigned as, if you will, a delegate. I'm like the mayor of the town who got assigned by the governor, okay? And I serve at the pleasure of the governor. Now, I know that's not how it works in our government, but I'm using this as my analogy, okay? But, like, essentially, the governor, who's the bishop, has assigned me to be in charge of this parish, right? And if you ever want to see something kind of silly, not really silly, but if you ever want to look at the way things are phrased, I think it's kind of interesting. I don't think it's silly, but it's just interesting the way it's phrased, is to read the pastoral changes on the OCA website, if you ever get a chance to. And you see how we phrase assignments. And such like that. It's you know, it's like this person has been made on top of their duties. You'll hear the word duties a lot, right? Because it's part of their role. They're being assigned in that manner, right? I was assigned here to take on the duties and the role of being the one who oversees this parish on behalf of the bishop, which we're going to talk about why is that the case in a minute. But I have that role. I fill that role for the bishop as like his delegate. On the altar, whenever you see this and stuff like that, especially like what I do on Holy Saturday where I serve liturgy out in the center, you'll notice on the edimentia, which is that document and stuff like that, it says the bishop's name on it. Whoever the bishop was that consecrated that altar, you see that bishop. Now, ours is still Bishop Dimitri, of blessed memory. But at some point, I'm assuming we'll get a new version because ours is getting a little worn. I'll edit that out. Kidding, that's not anything to worry about. But that's essentially saying, here, you have the permission to serve services here, right? You have been formally given this role, this offer to be here, to be in my stead, right? I serve essentially at his pleasure. I remember what I said, everything's assumed the bishop's here. That's why the deacon, again, still says, Master bless, right? He says, Master bless, even though, because I'm serving as though the bishop is serving there. Right? Now, I don't get all the fancy stuff and get to do two hands like I'm directing a choir when I bless people, but I'm standing in all that perspective of that. Right? Now, one last thing I want to talk about before I get into the administrative stuff. I know Anthony has a question, so I want to let him ask his question. Before I get into that, one other thing is oftentimes I get asked the question of, what really is, though, then the difference between a deacon, a bishop, and a priest, right? When it comes to the liturgical functions of the church. And the answer to that is, not a lot. The only main difference between them when it comes to the liturgical function, I'm talking about like blessings, confessions, and so on. The biggest thing is I can give a blessing, I can do confessions, I can serve liturgy by myself. I don't need anyone present, just like the bishop doesn't need anyone present, right? The deacon can only serve liturgy by himself with a special blessing to do so, which he has to serve a type of typikon or readers pre-sanctified or something of that nature. The Antiochians have an actual version of this that I would actually kind of find interesting the way they do it. It's like an expanded version of the typikon with the pre-sanctified liturgy. It's quite interesting for liturgic nerds like me. But really the only thing a deacon cannot do is do absolution prayers and give blessings. And that's it. Outside of that, he can do everything. He notices he's up to the altar, he goes around the altar, goes to the royal doors, he does all of that type of stuff, right? He's essentially, in many ways, filling the role that historically priests were first filling that role back in the early church when the bishop was the rector of the parish. When there wasn't, you know, a bishop over an entire diocese of like 30 churches in an area kind of a thing, which we're going to talk about again in a few minutes as well. But as the church grows and roles expand and such like that, they change. A deacon at one particular point had no other role other than to be a policeman in the church. He quite literally would tell people to be quiet. Okay? That's why one of the reasons that you notice in liturgy when he goes, and to do ages of ages, he's telling everybody, all right, church is starting. The bishop's in the altar. You better be quiet. Because as you'll notice during when the bishop's here, again, everything assumes that the bishop's present at all times. When the bishop's here, that's when he comes into the altar. It's right after the gospel is brought in. He comes in the altar with the gospel. He's been vested. He stands out here, looks all pious and royal, and it's a beautiful thing to witness, right? To see, right? And he's present there, and then we all go in together as we're singing the entrance, prayers and stuff like that. The prayers that are, I'm talking about the great entrance prayer that you hear, that come, let us worship and fall down before Christ, that prayer that we sing, right? As we enter into the altar together, right? The deacon comes out to make everybody remember, hey, okay, guys, he's in there. Stop talking, okay? Let's focus on what's more important now. We're ready to really get going on everything. Also, another thing is that it's not done practice anymore. I'll say the last thing about his job and stuff like that is back during the early church, and as the church expanded into, throughout Constantinople and throughout the East and such like that, one of his jobs was to tell, the men and women intermingled, because it used to be a time when men would be on one side and women would be on the other side. And he would basically, if he saw them trying to mingle with each other, he'd go in there and pull them over and stuff like that, and actually during the kiss of peace that's done during the creed, he would come out and, make sure people were essentially focusing on the creed and such like that. So he was a policeman in a lot of ways, a guard, sort of a security guard and stuff like that in his liturgical role. Now, it evolved into what it is now, but I like to talk about that as a little tangent in the sense of just being it, understood that every role in the church has a reason to it. On top of that, and this is the last thing I will say on that, and then we'll talk about the other thing after Anthony gets a chance to ask this question, which I know he's itching to ask me, is a question also gets asked is, when do they get ordained then? How do you ordain them? Right? Because I talked about a reordination. Reordination and a subdeordination happen before liturgy. The ordination for a deacon, a priest, and a bishop happens during the liturgy itself at different points in the liturgy when it assumes you need one for something. So a bishop gets ordained at the great entrance. The little entrance, not the great entrance. The little entrance, he gets ordained. Why? Because that's when the bishop would come into church. And that's when you would need the bishop to start the service official. Even though we've already been in the service at this point, it's presumed that. So when a bishop is made a bishop, that's when he's made a bishop at. When a bishop is made a bishop, he's still a priest at the time, because remember the level's up, right? Two priests will walk with that bishop who's going to be ordained a bishop, brings him through the royal doors, takes him around the altar four times, he kisses it four times, he goes around the altar three times, he kisses the corners four times, And then that he's ordained by when it's a bishop, it's multiple bishops that do the whole thing. They consecrate a bunch of them. When it's a priest getting ordained, he has two deacons with him, or one deacon. Sometimes you can only get one deacon in this case, who goes with him. And three deacons walk in the altar. The one who's getting ordained goes around the same thing like the bishop did and gets ordained in that same manner. Now, when a deacon's getting ordained, it's two subdeacons with the subdeacon who's going through, although this time the subdeacons don't go on the altar with the subdeacon. It's the first time the subdeacon goes into the altar, right? And when I got ordained, I don't know if this was the case for you, deacon. When I got ordained to deacon, it felt like I was like stepping into like something weird. But I'm like, oh, I'm gonna be careful. You're not supposed to go through the royal doors. That's how it felt, right? It's like, I'm not gonna get in trouble, right? Like I'm looking around thinking I'm not gonna get in trouble. Because you're not used to going through the doors. The subdeacon and the reader get ordained out here. The reader, remember I mentioned how it's assumed as an order of the priesthood? In the Slavic tradition, they actually put a little mini Philonian on him that looks like the Russian-style Philonian, right? Or you'll see the Greek styles on it.
I think they call it chaplain at one time.
Yeah. They put that on and stuff like that to remember, again, it's the first order of the priesthood. It's towards the priesthood. And that's how they get made a reader. So they get their cassock, they put on that, they read the prayers, they have to read from the epistle and such like that, and then they're a reader and things like that. The subdeacon gets the orarium put on him before church, and then he immediately has to wash the bishop's hands. Okay? And so he has to do stuff. Remember, everything's done with the assumption you're going to do something. A priest gets ordained at the great entrance because he's supposed to be present to help offer the sacrifice, which is something I didn't talk about, but I'm going to talk about in a second. And then the deacon gets ordained right before the Lord's Prayer, because what do deacons do the most? They do litanies. They do, in peace, let us pray to the Lord. And so he's needed for a litany. So that's why he's ordained at that moment in time, and things like that. And when he's ordained, you hear a bunch of oxios, 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 and the choir sings oxios. And anybody know what oxios means?
Worthy.
He's worthy. He's worthy. And if you hear an oxios, well, there's actually technically supposed to stop. If you hear an oxios, it's like, you know, speak now forever, hold your peace. You hear in like secular weddings. It's the same idea, but nobody practices that anymore. Which, thank God, because I had a few people I felt like were going to do that at my ordinations. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Just my wife. But anyway. So getting back to why that and why I explain all of that is, one or two guys understand that, like, here is the hierarchy of the church. This is how the church functions from that perspective. Now, I know Anthony wants to ask a question before I get on to the whole thing about jurisdictions and what the real talk about all this is. Anthony, go ahead and ask your question.
First, can you clarify for the people that are listening online and maybe people from other backgrounds, what do we mean and what do we not mean by master and bless? That's the first question. The second question is, for the next 12 people that are going to become priests from this church, what's the process that we go through to get that call?
Okay. So I'm going to answer your question backwards, because part of my jurisdiction talk talks about the whole idea of calling a master, right? And that role of the jurisdictions. So if I forget to bring that up again, please remind me. I know you will, but please remind me. But what is the process of going to becoming a priest from our 12 priests? Just 12? Come on. No. Yeah, I know, but I'm not trying to one-up Jesus, because we obviously can't. But let's at least go for like 13. I heard 13 is a really good number with him.
17.
We're not doing 13, okay? I'm kidding. You say 72?
That's the next level.
67.
I think 12 will work. Let's go at 12. All right. You say 60?
67.
60. You know what's funny about that? Now I can hashtag that. I can put that in there, because the transcript will pick that up, and I'll put hashtag in there, 6-7. So, I found your church on a little thing on there. I found your church because of 6-7. If that happens, I quit. Okay? If somebody finds our church because of a silly meme that's going on right now online, I quit. Okay, I'm just telling you right now. No, I'm kidding, I'm not quitting.
Got to build more
anyway,
churches.
I know, 670 churches. Anyway, so the process of being ordained, how that all works. Well, for all of that, technically you have to get the bishop involved. We're going to talk a little bit about how that works in a second. But typically if a young man wants to go and be a priest or a deacon or even a bishop, if you want to be a bishop, run. Nobody really wants to be a bishop. I mean, there are two, but and there's a calling for it. But really, if you want to be a priest, there's a process to that. The first step of that, of course, is you go to your priest and you say, "Father, I want to be a priest." And Father looks at you and goes, "Sure?" and you laugh, but honestly, that is the question that every priest has to ask. Are you sure? There's a lot to it, right? You're not just saying, "Okay, great." Remember I said in my sermon how I love going to church and I hate going to church at the same time, right? And I sound like a hypocrite and contradicting all the light, right? That is your life. The church is your life, right? Like, literally, you get asked the question, "Are you sure?" Because, well, you know, Dan's a former law enforcement officer and stuff like that, even though he had to probably do this at times and stuff like that. If someone called him and said, "I need you to come and help me out," and stuff like that, if his shift ends, he could probably just go home. If someone's in trouble. I'm not saying Dan would ever do that, because cops won't do that, right? But in all actuality, right? Or actually, the military guys could say this applies too with the priesthood, which is why a lot of military guys go into the priesthood, believe it or not, is if you're told by your commanding officer, you better be here tomorrow. Guess what? You're there tomorrow. You don't even ask. You just go, right? If somebody calls me up at 3 o'clock in the morning, like, you know, Jason, and tells me that he's having trouble with his, you know, Logan cosplay for Halloween, I'm going to say, "Jason, why are you calling me at 3 o'clock in the morning?" But if he's having a real crisis, sorry to pick on you, of course, he's in a real crisis, I can take his call, right? If he's in trouble, you have to take his call, right? I don't get to do that, right? That's why I jokingly said I haven't taken a vacation in so long, because really, do I ever? You know, because I'm always having to do something with regards to all of that, right? That's not a bad thing, per se, but that's part of the job. So you ask that question. Are you sure? Because your life... See you later, Cam. Drive safely, guys. Listen to the rest of the episode later. Part of the job is you're working 24 hours a day. That's fine, right? But you have to wonder yourself, why would you do that? Well, first off, because you love people and you want to grow the church and you love Christ. Ultimately, you love Christ. And then loving Christ, loving people, that's what leads one to do that, make that choice. But that is a real question that has to be asked. The second question is, obviously, the priest will ask is, you know, can you afford to go down that road? Now, that's something that we talk about a lot, is how do we pay for priests to go and go to men to go to seminary and take on that burden? Because there's a financial burden to it, too. Right? You're going to school for so many years, and then you may go to a parish that won't help you pay that off. I'm not saying that that's always the case, but it definitely is a risk, right, that you're going to go somewhere, and you don't know what's going to happen. And stuff like that. So you have to make that choice too. At least with the military, right? You know you're getting a paycheck. I don't know right now with the government shutdown. But that's like the priesthood all the time. You don't know if you're getting a paycheck or not, right? So a lot of times, a lot of men will wait to go to seminary and such like that until they're much older, until they've established themselves, right? So that they have those types of things available to them. So that they can go and do that kind of stuff. Now that's a conversation for another class, another time. But I didn't want to talk about it in particular because those are questions I first get asked. Why do you want to do this? Are you sure you want to do this? And do you know what this encompasses? Okay, are the questions that typically get asked. Once that has been solidified and the person goes, yes, the priest then will also find out, do you have any canonical impediments? They'll find out before the person wants to go to seminary. Because they don't want to waste that person's time, right? And canonical impediments can be things like, well, have you ever killed somebody? Have you ever done something sexually inappropriate with somebody? And we're not talking about like, you know, when you were a teenager and you did something that stupid high schoolers do, right? On prom night. We're not talking about like that, okay? Although that does factor in. Obviously, you should try to have a pure and chaste life, right? But, you know, we live in a culture that's just not possible nowadays. Sadly, we're going to get into that point. But, you know, it's more along the lines of, have you ever done anything with a child? That's a big red flag. Uh-uh. You're not going to get ordained if that's the case.
Murdered someone.
What's that?
I said murder.
Yep. If you murder somebody, if you did something sexually inappropriate, if you did something sexually inappropriate with somebody else, right? Not just a child, but with somebody else. Have you been married previously? Have you been divorced? Those are questions I'm going to ask too, because if anybody here has been married, right, who wanted to be a priest and they got a divorce, the first question would be, okay, now there is a situation in which you can still be ordained a priest if you've been married previously, but it depends on the need, depends on the circumstance and situation. In most cases, if you have been married previously, you don't get to get ordained. Okay, the other question you'll get asked is, were you ordained in any other church? Were you ordained, like, you know, I know Jesse, you were an Anglican at one point, right? Like, were you an Anglican priest before you became an Orthodox catechumen, and now you want to be an Orthodox priest, right? Now, that wouldn't prohibit you. That's not a canonical impediment, right? But that does factor into how are you brought into the church, as well as how are you brought in with that aspect of petitioning for priesthood, right? So these are some of the questions, and those are just a few of the questions. There's more questions than that, but these are just a few of the questions that are asked. So now that you have officially said, I'm good to go, then you go to seminary, presumably. Unless you're just going to be a deacon, then you would go through the diaconal vocations program, which the OCA has. Other jurisdictions have their own versions of that, right? If you're just going to do the deacon, now that's half a seminary degree and half a not a seminary degree, which means Deacon Vasily could go and finish his seminary, where he would just do a year at seminary, or 2 years possibly, depending on his, you know, where the bishop sees him in that regards, because some are different. It's all different. It's nothing to do with him personally. It's just what the bishop thinks he needs, right? But essentially, he's doing like an associate's degree, whereas I did like a bachelor's degree, even though it's a master's degree, and his was a certificate, okay? You go to seminary in the OCA, and in the Antiochian Archdiocese, it's 3 years. In the Greek Archdiocese, it's 4 years, If you're, well, taking that back to the OCA, you could technically do the St. Herbert's one in 4 years and do it as your college degree and your seminary at the same time together. But you do your seminary, and during seminary at different points, depending on which jurisdiction you're in, you get ordained a deacon and then a priest, and then you get assigned to a parish after seminary, either as an assistant priest for a couple years, or you go right into a parish, depending on where you're at. Now, that's a lot of information to take into, and I'm not expecting any of you guys to remember that part, because that part is just basically kind of giving you an overview of everything. That's not really the crutch of this whole conversation, talk, adult study, whatever you want to call it, form of catechism. But it's an important thing. That's one of the reasons I'm glad that Anthony asked that question, because that factors into what I'm about to talk to with regards to the church's structure and everything that I've set up to that. Right? Anthony asked this question earlier where he said, why do you say master bless? Why is the bishop called master? Well, remember when I talked about that, I said earlier, I said governor, and like the priest is like the mayor of the town type of a thing. Well, that's how the church itself is governed, right? We essentially, and I always like to use this as the best analogy here, the Orthodox Church is the United States of America in its governance, right? And what is the United States built upon? What is their foundational thing? I know people on TV will always go, Democratic Republic. No. What is it actually built on?
Constitutional
Republic. And what does a constitutional republic mean? Dan? Savannah, Dan, this is your moment.
The power lies with the people.
Power lies with the people, but even more so than that, talk about the states.
So each state is free and independent of one another. They're each autonomous. We are the free and independent, but United States of America.
Correct. The Orthodox Church is no different. Although the difference in this, I'll take that back. There's one difference. We don't utilize the word autonomous for all the states. We use it more along the lines of autocephalous, where all the churches are autocephalous. Meaning in the states themselves, it's more along the lines of we stick to the strict 10th Amendment. Right? What does the 10th Amendment say? All the powers that the federal government does not have, it's all left to the states to do, right? The states handle the rest. Like, here's your first 10. You only need these, really. But here's your first 10, and you do the, and we'll leave the rest up to you, right? And those first 9, you know, rights are basically just rights to sort of, like, overarching sort of say, here's the canon law, if you will, of everybody, right? Which is sort of like, here's your foundation. Now you do the rest, right? So the United States very much structured that way, right? Now, why is it I say the Orthodox Church and the United States are similar in that sense? It's because what did the United States base their constitutional republic on? Anybody know?
Rome.
Who said that? Good job, Landon. You get the gold star for today. Rome, right? Rome, the Roman Republic, right? We didn't, weirdly enough, like Rome, we give Rome a lot of flack. Right? We give the Catholics a lot of flack for what they did with splitting and the schism and all that. But in the sense of it, right? Like, one of the reasons we give them flack, one of the reasons why the Great Schism was such a big deal between East and West was because Rome abandoned the thing that they started. Literally, they started that. Right? Because why did the Roman government have to have a republic? Anybody know? Jesse?
It was a response to the, like, tyranny of monarchy. And it was like a balance.
You're on the right track with balance. Here's the way I look. Yeah.
The empire was huge.
It was huge. The empire was huge, right? Think of it like this, okay? All right, everyone here has a cell phone. Every single person here has a cell phone, okay? I can call you up right now. We can have a conversation, all right? Now, let's pull all the way back to that period of time, to even before Christ, okay? How do we talk to each other?
How if I, messages, letters.
Messages, letters. Right? How long does it take to get those to you?
Months.
It can take months. Years. Okay. What year did the Battle of Hastings happen? Anybody know? It's my favorite war of all medieval wars. 1066. You want to know why it's my favorite war?
Why?
Because it's the last time that an Orthodox king ruled over England. So I always find that interesting, right? So that's one of the reasons I find it interesting. Harold, the last Orthodox king of England. 1066. What year did the Great Schism happen?
1054.
Guess what England found out in 1066 after they got taken over by the French? Which they, you know, do not like the French. What did they find out? You're not Orthodox anymore. What did I just say? Last Orthodox king of Scotland. How many years is that? 1066 minus 1054. What's that? 12 years. It took them 12 years to find out there was a schism between East and West. You see what I'm talking about communications? That's insane. 12 years it took. For 12 years, they thought everybody was still okay and all happened. Yeah, they knew there were issues between everybody because, let's be honest, there had been issues from the beginning of time. So they knew that there were already issues going on between East and West. But when the people of that time are being told, yeah, you're under Rome now, they're like, no, we're under the Church of England. The Church of England is autonomous under Rome. Right? This is where autonomous comes into place. Right? We're a daughter church of Rome. Our bishops are equal to your Pope in the sense that they have, just like our Orthodox bishops of today, that Metropolitan Tikhon, for example, has the same amount of votes as Patriarch Bartholomew in Constantinople. Right? They're equal. 100% equal. Right? And at that moment in time, they were told, no, you're not. And they submitted to it. Right? Instead of fighting, they didn't have a choice because they were taking over. That's what happens sometimes when you lose a war. You know, sadly enough. But my point is that was 12 years that they had no idea. That's how long the conversation took. One of the reasons that took so long, well, because England's an island. Okay? And there's water they have to cross over. And that makes communication even harder. Right? That being said, so what did the Roman government do back in the time when because they understood and knew this, they created state ships, governor ships, right? They put people in charge of things, right? Pilate, for example, the most famous governor in really biblical history, if you will, right? Because he's the one that sent Christ to his death, you know? If we're going to be honest in this sense, right? What is he called? The governor, right? He's put in charge of an area. Is he in Italy where Rome's at? No. He's in, where's he at? Where particularly? Name the city. Because I'm getting somewhere with this. Jerusalem, right? This is where he's at, in Jerusalem. How far distance is Jerusalem to Rome? It's far, right? I don't know the exact measurements off the top of my head. If anyone has cell service in here and wants to give me the exact measurement, I'd be curious. Right? But he's put in charge of that, right? That was the whole thing. They set their government up to be able to stabilize. Because Rome did something else too. Right. Funny enough, we always say like, what is the thing like? When did Rome do like the Romans do? Right. You know that old expression. Right. One of the things the Roman government did is they would anytime they went over to a country or a nation or people or tribes and stuff like that, they made them Roman. They assimilated them into Rome. Right. And what do we do in the Orthodox Church when we go over to a country? We evangelize. Right. We tell people become Orthodox. Right? Or as X says, be gum Orthodox. I tried that joke. It didn't work. I know that was bad. 6-7. They evangelized. They tried to bring people, right? But Rome would say is, I take you over, you're now Romans. Right? Well, here's the thing though. You take that over, you then have to rule it. Because the emperor who's 3,000 miles away cannot rule. Like, for example, the English pikes, in this case, right, that they took over, cannot rule that. So he has to set a governor there. The Roman emperor cannot rule the Jews in Jerusalem and throughout Judea. So he has to set a governor there. The Greeks didn't practice this. The Greeks just basically destroyed you and in a sense. They didn't say, oh, you're one of us, right? They did, to a certain degree, try to assimilate them in. But by and large, it was mostly so they could have trade. So they could have your trade. The Romans said, nope, you're not Roman. It was like they get, Romans in a sense of it gave amnesty to everybody, right, in this sense. Now I know I'm very much overviewing this and nuancing this a little bit. But by and large, that was a structure of the Roman government. And they did that with this pretense and understanding of, well, you have a supreme leader, the emperor, and all these governors who answer to him. Now, the Orthodox Church did not follow that part of things. We did not sit there and say, yeah, that's what we're going to do in that sense. Because the thing about it is you don't, the church never reinvented the wheel on anything. What does Jesus say? I didn't come to destroy the law. I came to fulfill it, right? He didn't come to destroy what they already had. He came to Christianize, bring it back into a godly state, bring it to the kingdom of God, bring it to heaven in this sense, right? But he took what they had and he built upon it, right? Because guess what? He's the one that built it to begin with, right? As a creator, he set all the rules. Now he's showing you where the rules are at. But I digress in this sense of the church itself followed the exact same type of of understanding, right? We didn't take the synagogue and say, no more synagogues. What did we turn the synagogues into? Churches. We didn't say, no more Jewish liturgy. We created the divine liturgy, right? And those who were at the St. James liturgy a few weeks ago, right? Notice how similar that was to the St. John liturgy, right? It was so much like the St. John liturgy. It's kind of weird how much it's like the St. John liturgy, right? And that's a liturgy from the first century, you know? That's not like they took, they just said, okay, now we're going to start from scratch, right? You know, many of you who came from Protestant backgrounds, how often did you go to Protestant churches where they started from scratch, right? And they tried to pull back. We didn't have to do that because we already had that in place. We had the foundation in place, so we built upon it, right? Well, the church had the exact same thing in mind, right? They said, we have the same exact thing in place here, and we understand that as we grow this church, as we spread the gospel to the world, well, we need to use the tools that are ready, right? So what did Paul use, for example, at his tools of his ready when it came to preaching the gospel? Anybody?
Torah.
What's that?
The Torah.
Right, to a certain degree. He had the word. He had the scriptures, right? He used the scriptures with them, right? But he used his voice. He used his feet. He used writings. He wrote to them. He sent them letters, right? He used the tools at his disposal. And he also told them to structure themselves in the manner in which you don't sit there and just go along with everything that they're doing, right? But you don't take the things that they're doing and completely discard it, right? They use the things that they're ready. You know, if Jesus had come today, all right, he'd be in many ways probably utilizing televangelism, which I know is a dirty word to say in this sense, right? Because it would get the message out to many people, right? He wouldn't... I think for the purpose of it, he wouldn't today, for this one point, I should say, because I think that people would be too overwhelmed by it, right? It's sort of, they have to be brought into it more easily. But I digress in saying that the fact is that they utilized what they had. They didn't try to create something out of thin air. And one of the things that they utilized was the Roman, you know, governorship. Except for Rome, the Church of Rome, took a little bit further. We'll talk about that in a second, okay? And by second, I mean like 10 minutes from now. but the church took that and said, well, let's do that. Well, we have churches in various different parts of the world, right? You know, and the first, you know, sees, and I wrote this down because I didn't want to get any of these wrong in this order. You know, we had at the very beginning, we had Rome, Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, Jerusalem, and Cyprus. Those are the first, you know, we always talk about the first five sees of the church. So the first five states of the church. Okay? Now, out of those, five of those became patriarchates. One of them did not. One of them remained autocephalous. I like to call them, like, basically, you know, Puerto Rico in this sense. Puerto Rico is part of the United States. You could go there. You're an American citizen when you're there. You know, just like, you know, you go to the U.S. Virgin Islands, you're an American citizen there. As soon as you step over to the British Virgin Islands, you're like, you're a foreigner. You step back, you're back in American territory, right? You're fully 100% American. Except Cyprus did not want to be part of that patriarchate. For the sole reason is they were like the Commonwealth of Virginia. They don't like to be called a state. They're still in many ways a patriarchate. Because patriarchate is just an overarching sort of bigger state, if you will, right? And they didn't want to turn this into too much of the hierarchy. Because I mentioned about hierarchy and stuff like that, which I'm going to talk a little bit more. They thought, well, we're a small island. Why would we need to make ourselves a patriarchate when literally we're a small island by 12 villages? Okay? I know there's more than that in Cyprus, but they didn't see, why do we need to have a bishop in 12 different cities? Now we have a synod of 12. Okay? And where you're going to have states that have a synod of, like, let's say Russia, for example. Russia has thousands of bishops, you know? You don't want to turn it into a situation where now you've got 1,000 bishops who are dealing with this, when you don't need 1,000 bishops there. You'll be tempted to have 1,000 bishops in Cyprus when you don't need it. That's their argument. As the church continued to grow and so on and expanded to other countries, and things like that, they also expanded into other patriarchates. And I'm going to read the full list here, and then I'm going to talk about it a little bit more in this sense. So the next patriarchate was Moscow, Russia, Serbia, Romania, Bulgaria, Georgia. Cyprus got pushed all the way down because when you're autocephalous and you're not a patriarchate, you get pushed down a list. But this is technically where Cyprus comes in. Greece, which is autonomous. Poland, autonomous. Albania, autocephalous. Actually, I think Poland is actually autocephalous. The Czech lands of Slovakia, Macedonia, the OCA, Sinai, which is autonomous under Jerusalem, Finland, which is autonomous under Constantinople, Japan, China, which are both under Moscow, Estonia, Ukraine. Now, we're not going to talk about the Ukrainian issue because I don't really want to get into that. Unless you have a question, I can do it after the talk. Okay, because Ukraine has, depending, there's Moscow, there's also Constantinople, there's the whole thing with that. That's a whole other thing in itself. But I guess I'll talk about it a little bit in this sense. So I read off those different, you know, states, if you will. Now, you notice with those states that they all spread out throughout the world, right? Now, I gave you the full list, but I included Rome in the original list. Now, obviously, Rome doesn't exist in that list anymore. Which, who's the first one on that list now? Anybody?
Constantinople
is the first, right? What does that mean for Constantinople? Why is Constantinople the first on that list? Does anybody know? Or what do they call? What's their title?
Well, I mean,
first among equals.
First among equals. They're the first among equals. The reason why they get that title is because of their placement in the world. Yeah, that definitely factored into it. I know where you're going at with this. That definitely factored into that. That hierarchy definitely factors into where you're at in the world. Today, that doesn't really matter anymore. Today, it would not matter. From the church's structure of things, none of that matters anymore. Back then, it did. Because of communications, travel, and trade. That's why those things mattered back then. That's why those points were made as those C's, there's S-E-E, or patriarchates, and so on. The first among equals thing is understood within the church that everybody here is equal, but somebody still has to go first at the buffet line. This is Father Alexander Mantola, it's just a joke about in class. Right? Someone has to go first, right? You know, you can't just sit there and go, yeah, you go first, or you go first. Somebody better go first. Somebody has to go first. In terms of everything, Constantinople has, Patriarch of Bartholomew has no more power in terms of his own patriarchate than Metropolitan Tikhon and the OCA. He cannot call it Metropolitan Tikhon and say, hey, you know what? I changed my mind about this whole women ordination thing. Guess what? We're ordaining women now as priests. You do too. And Metropolitan Tikhon, if he gets that phone call, can go, that's very nice of you to say that. Have a nice day. Hang up right up on him. Okay? I guarantee you he'd hang up on him. On that one. Okay? He's a very quiet and solid man, so he'd do it a lot nicer than I would. But anyway, right? You can't tell him what to do because our government is set up to where the states don't get to tell each other what to do, right? They all play by the same sort of overarching rule, but the one thing, and this is where I want to get at with all of this, the one thing is that one of the biggest reasons for the schism with East and West was that Rome took the first among equals as, I'm not the first among equals, I'm the first above equals. And they're not even equals. It's the old thing with animal. Remember the book Animal Farm by Orwell, right? Some animals are more equal than others, and eventually turns into no animals are equal, just the supreme lord type of a thing. That's what they ended up doing, right? They took monarchy to the thing that they were trying to prevent. The church was trying to prevent that because the church understood back then in the first century, that's not going to work. Back then in the second century, it's not going to work. Back then in the third century, Constantinople became basically the center, and the Byzantine Empire became the center, understood that. The fourth century understood that. It wasn't like they sat there and said, they said, this is not going to work because we know how big the world is, right? Just think about how long it takes any of you to get to church, right? Some of you takes a couple hours. Some of you takes 10 minutes. Some of you takes 30 minutes. Some of you, don't try walking that. This town's a lot bigger than people realize, and stuff like that. Everything. The whole world is that way, right? And we look at the universe. I mean, go, you look at this is the space, you see pictures of like, you know, that one Voyager, I think the Voyager picture shows the last picture of Earth or something like that. It's like the size of a pixel on your computer. It's ridiculous how big things are, right? The church understood this from the very beginning. They absolutely 100% understood this from the very beginning. And so when you had someone like Rome coming in and saying, well, we don't care because now we're going to tell you what to do. And we're going to tell you that we're above you. And essentially, it's almost like a shadow government was formed in this sense, right? It'd be like the equivalent, I like to tell it in the sense of saying, without getting into politics or something like that, it'd be like the governor of California, which we all know is the most cherished person on the planet. I'm joking, okay? For the people in California that might listen to this, I'm sorry, please run. I'm not getting into politics, I'm just saying, right? It'd be like the equivalent of that governor saying to Georgia, all of us here, you're now under us. I get to tell you what to do. Good luck with that, okay? I guarantee you, if Newsom called up, you know, Brian Kemp, I think Brian Kemp's the governor, said, guess what? You're going to pass all these laws because I said you will. Brian Kemp's also going to hang up the phone on him, right? Because you can't do that. But Rome was starting to do that. The Church of Rome was saying, no, we don't want this anymore. We don't want this. Because we're the first, that means we're also the one in charge. Because the other thing about it is, too, and I like to also compare this with the United States government, is who are the most powerful people in the United States government within the the legislation? Who are the most powerful people? Anybody know? The Speaker of the House. Who else?
Vice President.
That's the executive. We're talking about the Congress. So in the Congress, who's the most powerful people? The Speaker of the House. The majority Senate leader, and I guess you could say the minority Senate leader, right? You know, what do? They rally the troops, right? They get the entirety of the other senators and House of Representative members in their own. And you also have the House minority leader and the House majority leader, right? And the Speaker of the House is sort of the overseer of that. But in reality, really, the House Speaker is nothing in comparison. He is the leader of the House, but really, he's no different than any of them, right? Because who's the current? Mike Johnson's, right? The current Speaker of the House, right? Does Mike Johnson get more votes than anybody else?
No.
Does the House Majority Leader get more votes than anybody else? Does the House Senate Leader get more votes? Does the House Minority Leader or Senate Minority Leader? No. They all get the same amount of votes. That's how the church was structured. Except for this, now it would be, well, Rome is saying the House Majority Leader gets all the votes, or gets more votes. Or essentially, you know, it's like the Vice President can come in and change a tiebreaker, right? He can come in and vote against a tiebreaker. You know, if there's a 50-50 situation, he can come in and vote, right? It's like that, only it's the Senate Majority Leader would come in and say, I get to change the tiebreaker. What does that do if the Senate Majority Leader gets to change the tiebreaker? What does that give him? More votes. Gives him two votes. And Rome said, that's who we are now. We get the move because we're the first of our equals. We're the one that the church looks at and says, here, look, we are the start, we're the hierarchy, we're the first among all of this. Therefore, we should have that saying, right? Because of various different reasons. One of them was the fact that who did Christ give the keys to first?
Peter,
right? You know, but what often gets, you know, left out in all of that is Peter is the apostle to the Jews. Who is the apostle to the Gentiles?
Paul,
right? Hey, look at this. We got bishops now, and now we got bishops that are basically, you know, first among equals and equals among equals, right? So you see how the church was always structured in that way? It was always leading in that way? And then they got into their head that, hey, you know what? We want to be more in charge. Now, there's a reason for that. There's actually a reason for that happened historically. The reason for that is obviously shifts were happening in the government and the society throughout the world, right? Rome, as an empire, split. And does anybody know what the two names of those empires were called?
East and West Rome.
East and West Rome, but what were their more proper titles?
The Roman and the Byzantine Empire?
Close. Byzantine Empire and
like the Holy Roman Empire.
And the Byzantine Empire, right? They split. Now they actually split twice within their own. So there was actually four empires together. They split into two things, but I don't want to get into all of that. But in that shift of split, well, things were changing because essentially the West became the West and was going one way, and the East was going another way. And the four patriarchates, with Cyprus hanging out with basically Greece, right? Anybody in Greece, because every church was under, any church that was in an area of territory was under that church, right? The East went their way. East was dealing with their stuff. There were things like wars happening at the time, like the Muslim invasions of throughout the world, right? And there was also a change in governance in some of those countries, right? The West didn't have the problems that the East was having when it came to the wars. The West had their own problems, but it was tribes against tribes. In many ways, it was Christians against Christians or Christians against pagans, right? It wasn't like one giant enemy against a bunch of enemies, where that was the issue in the East, right? Who did the East have to fight? The Muslims. That's how they largely fought with the Muslims. Yeah, they fought other people from time to time, but mostly they fought the Muslims, right? In that, they had to maintain what they already had, whereas the West started to shift and deal with things because something else that was brewing was monarchies. Monarchies were starting to happen. And in that, well, what do you do? What did I say earlier? What do? We imitate things. We imitate what we know and what we see. And even though we may know this and stuff gets written down, but back then, not everybody knew every single bit of history. They only took what they had. And so Rome started imitating what it was doing, because I'm not saying that the Roman popes were not knowledgeable men. They obviously were, right? But they were going with the waves of the tide and seeing, hey, you know what? West is forming into monarchy. We should be a monarchy too. Which is one of the reasons why the Roman, you know, church had a military, which is why they saw the Pope like a king, because other kings were forming, right? And why were other kings forming? Did anybody know the reason why? Why did the West go with the kings and monarchies? Anybody know?
Control over them. The Pope usually had authority to crown.
No, this goes all the way actually to the Vikings, because they had tribes. Tribes are ran as monarchies. Tribes are not ran as republics. And so they saw something that they could imitate, and that's what they imitated.
Yeah, well, especially with the Germanic tribes.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Germanic tribes, Norwegian tribes, Russian tribes, all of that. Now the Russian tribes eventually just became Orthodox. So what did they eventually try to do? They tried to imitate the West. Russia tried to be like the West in Petersburg, right? You know? That's why in some Russian churches you'll see iconography. It looks very Western. But that's a whole other conversation in itself. My point is, the church imitated there. Rome became Rome because it started imitating where it was at. Whereas the East didn't do that. The East maintained that republic style of governance. To this day still maintains that republic style of governance. To a certain degree. Okay? There still was a place for a centralized first among equals. There even was a place for a pope. Right, there was even a place to where Rome could say they were the House Majority Leader, the Senate Majority Leader, with the second vote when it came to, building upon what was best for the church. But that was lost when the Great Schism happened. That all basically fell away. East went their way, West went their way. We're in the mess we're in today in some aspects because of that. I don't try to digress too much on that. But by and large, the church's structure changed from that, and Rome went its own way in that regard. Whereas East still to this day maintains that same sort of structure where every church is autocephalous or autonomous and it's its own state. In other words, it's the United States the way the United States is supposed to be, right? Where California doesn't tell Georgia what to do, right? Where, you know, Nevada doesn't tell Georgia what to do, or New York tell Georgia what to do, or even Florida, its closest neighbor, tell them what to do. Right? It's just we have a centralized foundation that we follow, and we're all in one gigantic communion with one another. The United States is that way too, right? You don't have to get a driver's license to go drive in Florida, do you? Does anybody here have to get a driver's license to drive? No, right? Your driver's license is good here. It's good there too, right? It's like your baptismal certificate. It's good here. It's good in any Orthodox church, right? So then this leads to the last point of this, and then I'll leave it open for questions and such like that. So, and I appreciate you guys staying with me and all this. I know it's a lot of information. How does that explain America then? How do we understand orthodoxy in America in this perspective? So I told you how the governance of the church is supposed to work, right? But what does that impact, how does that impact America? Well, America is a weird sort of situation. Because again, going back to America, America is the first country on the planet that is not founded on ethnicity, but founded on ideas. In this sense, am I right on that so far, Dan, on that part? Okay. You're the historian on that one. I have to pivot to you on that because I'm not an expert on that part. America is not founded on, okay, because I'm Greek, therefore I'm part of this country, right? In that sense, America is founded on this concept. Everybody from all different walks of life can essentially live here, and we focus on the character of the person and less on the where they were born, sort of a thing, right? I think Martin Luther King Jr.'s message was really what America was about, was supposed to be about, in this sense. And I know it's changed a lot of ways, and it's not quite that. But getting back to this point, right? Because America is not a country that is founded on ethnicity, we don't have that nationalism that inherently was part of the church from the very get-go, right? One of the reasons why the church put those places, those churches in those areas and made those the capital cities of those areas is because they also represented a particular ethnicity of that, you know, area, right? Constantinople was a big-time trade town, right? The modern-day Istanbul was a big-time trade town, right? And a lot of people from coming all different walks of life and such like that, but it was predominantly a Greek town, right? People spoke Greek there. They spoke, you know, Byzantine Greek back in the day, but they spoke Greek, okay? People in Russia spoke Russian or a form of Russian. Modern day Russia, Russian is not like the language they spoke. What you hear in church, when you hear Church Slavonic and stuff like that in a Russian parish, it's not what they didn't even speak that, okay? That was something that was later on that, you know. Now, if you go to a Ukraine and you hear them do it with a Ukrainian accent to Slavonic, that sounds closer to what Russia sounded like back then, okay? Back in the 10th century, right? My point is different countries had different sort of ethnic tribes, so to speak, ethnic groups to it. And so the church put those states. Why do we divide states up in this country the way we do it, right? Because of various different cultural things too, right? We do the exact same thing. But we weren't founded on doing that. They were founded. They had to do that. Because you can't tell somebody in England what to do and without having the foundation over here. And you have to understand that, hey, they're going to speak English over here, or their form of English, right? And we're going to speak this language, and we have to have some sort of common way of understanding one another, right? That's one of the reasons we divide it up, as I was trying to say. Right? Well, the same thing in America. America said, let's do the exact same thing as the Roman Republic did, and let's divide up ours too. So we're going to build ourselves on the ideals, but really America tried to build itself on a Roman ethnic style in that sense. But the thing is you can't, if you separate that, you've lost it, right? They completely took it. They tried to do like basically the English version of Rome. And that's part of the problem, but that's a conversation for another day, okay? America's an interesting country in that sense. Because in America, we are founded where we took the Roman model of statehood and splitting it up to that by territories, right? But we also tell everybody, it doesn't matter what your background is, even though technically we wanted everyone to be white. We wanted everyone to be Anglo-Saxon, right? Essentially. Or you were either French. Like, we did start to do that ethnic thing. Okay? And this is not meant to be about a race thing, right? But we did basically try to create an Anglo-Saxon 2.0, okay, in America. At the same time saying we don't care what you are. Now that works, and that's a good thing. I don't think there's a problem with having everybody, because remember, the Orthodox perspective and the church's perspective, it doesn't matter if you're a Greek, Russian, American, it just matters if you're an Oilers fan. Okay? I really wanted to make that joke, so. But it really doesn't matter, right? No Jew, no Jew or Greek, no master slave, right? The church's foundation doesn't care about that. So in that sense, that's what America was trying to do with Judeo-Christian values, okay? But America also throughout its history has said, we need to influx ourselves with culture, Because ideas is one thing. We can basically turn this into England 2.0, which is what the colonists tried to do in some sense, of turning it into to England 2.0. But they didn't want England 2.0 with all the monarchy stuff. They wanted to be the republic, which was great, you know? But as they grew, they started taking on the classifications, or something, not classifications, they were absorbing some of the ethnic sides of things, right? And that's not, again, not a bad thing, but they were absorbing some of the cultural sides of that too, and saying, hey, you know what? There's people who want to be part of our ideals, so we're going to bring them over here. And the Industrial Revolution brought over a lot of people to America. A lot of people of all different types of backgrounds. People from all over the world who came with various different things. And what were the things that those people came with? Anybody want to say?
Religion.
Religion's one of them.
Language.
Language.
Food.
Food, yeah, definitely. Religion, language, food.
Culture.
Culture. Anything else?
Skill sets.
Skill sets, thank you. They came with religion, language, food, culture. Well, the food and culture are kind of the same in some ways, right? But not really, right? And skill sets, right? America wanted the skill sets, but knew if they wanted to get the skill sets, they had to get everything, right? What do people bring with them when they, the most on that, they bring the other four, right? But the most important thing for them on the other four is their religion, their churches, right? And so you had all these churches coming over here. Now, the Industrial Revolution is what kicked it off the most, right? Obviously, we had the settlers to Alaska who came down. We had the Greeks that came prior to that made their way throughout the Midwest and made their way out west and made their way east and so on. And I know that we had small pockets of that, right? But we really didn't have that influx until the Industrial Revolution. And the church came with it all as well, right? Now, governmentally wise, the church did at one point in time in this country have just one jurisdiction. There was just one Orthodox jurisdiction. There were Greeks here with Greek bishops. There were Antiochians or Arabs with Antiochian bishops. There were Serbians here. There were Russians here, right? St. Raphael of Brooklyn, who was an Antiochian bishop, right, was friends with St. Tikhon, who was a Russian bishop. Well, eventually a Russian bishop, right? They knew each other. They were all part of one jurisdiction, okay? They all were part of this whole thing. And then something happened. Anybody know what happened? New York's about to go through this. Communism. Communism happened. Oh, come on. I'm not getting political, but come on. That's what's happening, all right? I say that, I'm not getting political. Now let me get political. But communism happened. The Bolshevik Revolution happened. Now, let's play on a Dan's comment about skill set, right? The people stayed because of their skill sets. They had made their way throughout the country because of their skill sets and replaced in various different parts of the country because of their skill sets. I came from a parish in Colorado that literally is a skill set parish, okay? Every single person there had ties all the way back to Slovakia, not every person, most of the people there in that parish, back to Czechoslovakia and Slovakia, right? And what did they bring with them? They're literally farmers that ranch, or like a ranch cattle. Right? That's literally what they came to Colorado for. They didn't go to Colorado because they're like, oh, we like Colorado. One day we hope we can have this and this and this here. They came because that was where they were given land. The Homestead Act is a good part of that, right? You know, the Ukrainians went up to Minnesota because they could do fishing and they were really good fishers. Pennsylvania, they like to say Pennsylvania is a little Orthodox hub, because it's all steel workers from Russia, right? Alaska has a big Orthodox community up there, right? Because they're all, the Inuits converted, right? But they're all fishermen, right? Now, they weren't the skill set brought in. They were actually already there and converted, right? But various different ethnic groups traveled throughout the country based on their skill sets, right? Now, when the Bolshevik Revolution happened, what happened to all the Russians in America?
They left.
Not all of them, but a good chunk of them left, particularly the bishops and the priests left. Because, one, they had to go save the church in Russia, okay? Then what else also happened at the exact same time as the Bolshevik Revolution was going on? Well, a little bit afterwards.
World War One
happens. And then we've got other people leaving for stuff like that. And who is the big bad enemy in World War One? It's not just the Germans. Who's the other big bad enemy?
Germany.
What?
The Ottomans.
Japan's World War II. Right? The Ottomans, right? And who do the Ottomans really, really, or who really doesn't like the Ottomans?
Greeks.
The Greeks don't like the Ottomans. Literally, they have a whole Independence Day just about that. Ohite, okay? Which is also Annunciation. So if you ever don't come to church on Annunciation, you have to tell me that's the reason why. Okay. You're celebrating Independence Day. I'll tell you you should have been in church, but I'll understand. But anyway, please, you got to come to church on Annunciation. But they have a whole day, right? That's their big day. You know, they don't like them. Why? Because they were under their control for how many years? Anybody know?
400.
A little more than that.
500, 600.
1453 to basically the late 1800s. I don't remember the exact day that they declared independence.
1841 or something.
Something like that. So a little less than, like roughly around 400. Did you say 400, Dakota?
No, I didn't.
Oh, Chad did. Okay. I thought you said it. So like 400 years. You were close. It's closer to 500 years, give or take, I think is the exact amount. But you were right with the 400. They were under their control. They didn't like that they were under that control. Stuff like that. So you got that going on. They're trying to save the church. They're trying to do all these things. Well, what's that happened to America? Remember I told you we did have one jurisdiction at one point? It was called the Federation. So for the Star Trek nerds, you know, we did have a federation in the church at one point. Okay? What happened to the church? Well, it got stripped of its people. There were no longer bishops and priests that were here building churches. The church went through a big flux of building lots of churches for a while, and then like stopped building churches until like the 1950s. And then they went to another big, huge flux of building churches. And on top of that, weirdly enough, in a good way, right? In the sense of it, right? One of the key figures in Orthodox American history, Father Alexander Schmemann, who is literally came to America because of the stuff going on in Russia, right? Went through France and made his way to America. Built the seminaries. And, you know, you have Father Stephen here today because of that, you know? And other priests throughout the country, and even some of the world, right? The current patriarch of Alexandria, I think, the current patriarch, it's the same last right? So, I mean, there's a lot of good there. You know, in that sense. Now, when all that stuff is going on, it stripped the church of a lot of its necessary things. Well, people, what do? When people lose some foundational things, right? What do they immediately do?
Stray away.
They just stray away. But they also do something else.
Look for something to fill that.
Kind of in this sense. Okay, let me say this like this, okay? And if nobody wants to answer this question, I would totally understand. Okay? Does anybody have anybody in their family they are estranged from? Raise your hand if you are or not. Estranged. You will not talk to those people, no matter what. Okay? So you do. Okay. Now, is it on your wife's side? I'm going to pick on you, Dakota. Can I ask you some questions? So is it on your wife's side or
no,
your side?
Mine.
Your side. Okay? Great. Not great, but... Is you want to tell me who it is, like a brother or a sister or somebody?
It's it.
You don't have to give me all the details.
Grandfather,
perfect. Okay, good. Please forgive me for asking a personal question in a sense and things like that, and I appreciate you giving it. So your grandfather, right? So when you're estranged from your grandfather, is he still alive?
He is.
Okay, so you don't talk to your grandfather at all. In many sense of the words, and again, understanding it from this perspective, your grandfather in a sense of it is like out of your life entirely, right? Like whatever happens with you and your grandfather, which I pray that you guys will reconcile and forgive one another, but if that doesn't happen, I can't do anything about it, but I can't ask you to forgive, right? But in all of that situation with your grandfather, like it's like he's in a sense is dead to you, right? That there's a lack of him there. Who do you retreat to when you can't talk to your grandfather? Were you close to your grandfather before things got estranged?
Well, the individual that is my biological grandfather, that's the person I do not speak to.
Okay, let's
I did have a grandfather.
Okay, so let's play to our hypothetical here, okay? And let's just keep it this, because we're going to change this story up a little bit to get to the point. Because I don't want you to get into your own personal life for the sake of this, right? Give me that. But we're going to say that your grandfather that you're estranged from, okay, they used to have a really close relationship with him. And now you don't have that relationship with him anymore. So who did you retreat to? Who would you retreat to in that case? Your wife, right?
Right.
So you know, in the sense of it, you retreat to your wife. My point I'm trying to get to with all of this is, what did the churches do? What did they do? What did the people in the churches do? When they were estranged, not in a negative sense like yours was, or in the negative sense of, you know, it wasn't like their bishops abandoned them. They didn't have a choice. They were called to go save the church. And the people there said, do what you got to do. Right? Not in those words exactly, but they said, do what you got to do. Right? Save the church. You know? We can't have a church without bishops, so go. Do what you got to do in those countries. Right? Of course, they didn't realize they were going to kill them anyway. They thought maybe they could go there and do something else to save it, right? But what did they do? They retreated to their own hubs. To their own, if you will, ghetto hubs, if you will. Okay? And they created what is known, the term is known as diaspora. Right? They created these diasporas, these little pockets of their ethnic groups and the ethnic clubs, and so to speak. And they sort of formulated into this. And then, after things stabilized overseas, instead of coming back together and going, okay, time to do that, right? Like, you get used to the idea of being estranged to somebody that you kind of don't really want them anymore. If they do reconcile with you, it's hard to reconcile with somebody, but it wasn't like this in the church in this sense. It was more along the lines of, they got really used to their own little thing, right? That they embraced it. They embraced being Greek. They embraced being Russian. They embrace being Arab. They embrace being Serbian. They embrace being Romanian, right? Just like how many people, and part of the reason they did that was because imitation is key. Humans in general imitate everything, okay? They embrace the same thing that they also saw other people doing, right? What do the Italians do? Italians do their own thing together, right? How often do the Italians in New York, for example, mingle with other people? Not very often. I mean, you go to New York City, there's whole areas. They're like, this is the Italian area, right? If you've ever been to New York, Little Italy is not Little Italy. Arthur Avenue is Little Italy, okay? That's a really Italian area. There's also the Jewish area, the Hasidic Jews, the Orthodox Jews. That's a really Jewish area, just their people, right? Same thing in the church. The Russians did the same thing. The Greeks did the same thing. The Serbians, everybody did that. Because everybody else was doing that, okay? So what did they do? Well, the whole crux of this whole talk. They formed new jurisdictions. They had to go to their bishops to get things because America did not have a single jurisdiction anymore. Right? They tried to. They even had a council back in 1918 to try to have a singular jurisdiction. Right? There was one singular jurisdiction that existed at the time, and it's what the OC eventually became. It was called the Metropolitan. Right? And it was a daughter church of Russia. It was the Russian, and you notice that in the binder where I talk about, I have the section about America and why that's in there. It's because it talks about the Metropolitan and how the church itself, you know, in America sort of rounded itself around that. Because what was happening was that the Metropolitan said, look, guys, we're not Rome. We're not these things. We have we're not like multiple states in one state. We're one state. This is our state. America is our church. This is the church where we're at. Not America is our church. But I meant like the church is here. We're one Orthodox church. We don't need to have a Greek Orthodox archdiocese. We don't need to have an Antiochian archdiocese. We don't have to have a Serbian archdiocese. We just have to have one archdiocese. Okay? And at the time, Russia was like, yeah, you're right. We agree with you. In the 1970s, they said, yep, you're right. Because the OCA, the Metropolia, went to Russia and said, we need a singular jurisdiction. Will you grant us autocephaly so we can be that singular jurisdiction in the United States? Can you allow us to be the self-governing church and be our own state? In other words, we're petitioning for statehood. And patriarchates can grant statehood. Okay? Patriarchates can grant that. See you later. They can grant that. They can say, okay, you know what? You now have statehood. The Church of Greece, for example, is under Constantinople. If the Church of Greece was to go to Constantinople and say, we want to be our own patriarchate, Constantinople can say, yep, you can. They can also say, nope, you can't. Okay? They get to have the final say on that, because that's part of their daughtership in that sense. In a sense of it, in a way of saying it, in a weird way of saying it, it's like, if Savannah wanted to split off into its own state, I don't think there's a law in the government that allows us to do this, but if the state wanted to split, I guess like how Virginia split into West Virginia and regular Virginia. I don't think they call themselves regular Virginia, but right? That came from those two that talked about it, right? That split it. Of course, I know there was the whole, the United States had the rest of the two-thirds or whatever of the states had to agree to that, right? But it was them that made that call first. Well, the equivalent here would be that they don't have to go to the two-thirds of the other states to do this, okay? Which is why the Moscow recognizes the OCA and says, look, we gave it to them. We gave them autocephaly. That's why they're in that group of communion or churches that are in communion, right? Those states. They're a full state. However, because of those other jurisdictions that existed and something like that formed out of the diasporas of their ethnic states and things like that, they said, we don't recognize that because we have not come together to recognize that as a church in the country. We need to have some sort of a council, not an ecumenical council, but some sort of a council to deal with this problem, and we need to basically figure this out. And the Orthodox Church doesn't do anything quickly, right? They take forever. So like, 100 years from now, when your grandkids are grandparents, then we'll have an actual OCA. That's the plan, you would think. I think it should be sooner than that. I think they should just get over themselves and just have one church in the United States. But I digress. That's my personal opinion. I think that's the opinion of pretty much the entirety of the OCA, or else we wouldn't exist in the OCA if we didn't believe that. But those other jurisdictions formed throughout the United States as a result of all the stuff that happened historically, as a result of wars, as a result of contention throughout other countries, and things like that, where people retreated to where they were comfortable at, retreated to their communities, retreated to the people that they thought had their best intentions so that they could survive, right? Because one of the reasons that people, when they're estranged from others, right, will do certain things is for survival, right? We formulate tribes and communities for survival too, right? We don't just form it because we like somebody, I mean, yes, in many ways, we become friends with people because we like the person, in that sense of it too. But we also look at them and go, yeah, that's the kind of person I want to be friends with because I know, like for example, I give Jason a hard time and I tease him, right? But I know for a fact that if I had a flat tire and I called up Jason, he's the first person that would come, right? Now, obviously as your priest, I have to care for you regardless. But if I wasn't a priest, I would want you to be as a friend because I know your heart. Right, I know your heart would be, he would come and help. Right, we do the same thing with our friends. We do the same thing with our families. Right, we pick those people for those reasons too. And the church did the exact same thing. And unfortunately, in our country, we are in a situation where we're currently living through all of that. We're living through the results of that. Now, I give a very broad overview of all of that, and I know I've gone way over on the talk, but you're still here, so it's a good thing. Hold on a second, Anthony. I'm going to get to questions in a second. But the bottom line is, and again, to summarize all of this, to understand the situation in America and how it all works and the situation with where we're supposed to work is we're supposed to have 50 individual Orthodox states. Like we have 50 individual United States. But to summarize it in my analogy, in this sense, I'm a Nevada, Georgian. Or Colorado, Georgian. My wife's in Utah, Georgian. My daughter's in Nevada, Georgia, because she was born in Vegas, right? And all of you who are not born in this state are from other states, and that's your Georgian state. And I answer to Nevada, Georgians, instead of just Georgians. And the church is not built around that. The church is not built to just to sit there and say, yeah, you answer to that. So the mission of the OCA has always come down to, we're all Georgians, we're all Americans. We're the American church, right? We should have an American patriarchate, right? We should have a singular patriarch and then a synod that's made up of bishops. And if you want to have the ethnic diocese within, you can have them. Because guess what? The OCA has that too, right? We have the Albanians, we have the Bulgarians, we have the Romanians. I'm sorry, the Albanians are the Greek archdiocese. We have the Bulgarians and the Romanians, okay? There's nothing to say we couldn't do the other dioceses and jurisdictions. Now, I can tell you the reason why we don't have that, in my opinion. And this is solely my opinion, So I want to give a big disclaimer on this, and I don't want to cause anybody to feel like they're sinning with what I'm about to say. Okay? My opinion on the matter, my personal opinion on this, the reason why we don't have a unified jurisdiction yet is money. And I don't say that to make light of it or make a joke of it or anything like that. Those outside jurisdictions send a lot of money overseas to their patriarchs to keep them going. They still obtain that same mindset that exists. Constantinople is a good example of this. Constantinople barely is holding on. That who's under Constantinople in this country? Greek Archdiocese. And that could get me into trouble to say, you know, that the Greek Archdiocese is funding, you know, this evil patriarch in Constantinople. Patriarch Bartholomew is not evil, okay, in any way. All right, I'm not trying to imply that at all. What I am saying, though, is the Greeks become part of the OCA, Constantinople might get overtaken by the Turks.
How about Antioch?
Antioch's the same exact problem. Exact same problem. You know? Every jurisdiction outside of the OCA has this problem in some way or another. Now, they've tried to sort of figure out how they're going to sort this out. We have an organization in this country. We've had a couple over the years, but we have one in this country within the bishops called the Episcopal Assembly. And the idea behind that is they're trying to be the OCA. They're trying to create the OCA without losing that, right? And as I said, bishops get together and they talk about stuff and nothing gets done. But eventually things get done. Because there's a lot of good work that's been done, right? I'll end this on this one thing, right? So I had a conversation with Bishop Aliyah, blessed memory. He was actually the priest in Las Vegas at St. John's Greek Orthodox Church when I was a kid and things like that. And, you know, he was very Hellenic for a very long time. And I had a conversation with him when I first got ordained a priest. In fact, actually, weeks after I was ordained a priest. And at a Lenten retreat that he gave, he was one of the big figures in regards to the Episcopal Assembly. And we had a really interesting conversation because he talked about how much it had changed. The Episcopal Assembly had changed his perspective on things. He was a widowed man who became a bishop, who was in charge of the Albanian diocese within the Greek Archdiocese, and it made him see how much we need to be unified, right? And he was one of the ones making the charge for unification. And this is a Greek guy who was actually saying, you know, what are we doing here, guys? So there's obviously people, and sadly he passed away a number of years ago, but they're obviously doing work to try to unify it. But that is the state of our country right now with the Orthodox Church. The Orthodox Church right now has a lot of jurisdictions. A lot of jurisdictions. And they're violating essentially St. Ignatius's one bishop, one city rule like crazy. I mean, think about it from this perspective. Savannah has two bishops that are over Savannah, in a sense. Right? Archbishop Alexander and Bishop... starts with S. I cannot remember the Greek Archdiocese bishop for here. The one over Atlanta. Sebastian.
I remember.
Right? They have Metropolitan Sebastian and Archbishop Alexander are technically the bishops of one area. Church is not supposed to have that. But we do. Eventually, God willing, hopefully before I die, we won't have that problem anymore. Hopefully, and this is my message, one reason I wanted to talk about this with you guys, hopefully you'll help lead that charge. And that you'll say, we need a unified American church, right? Because honestly speaking, who cares what you are, right? Really, we're Americans. Our whole identity of Americans is to promote that we're all Americans, right? Right? In a sense of it, America is supposed to promote the same idea that Christ promoted and the same ideas that Paul preached. When he said there's no Jew, no Greek, no Gentile, you know, no Jew, no master, no slave, and so on, right? All of us here, regardless of our backgrounds, are supposed to be, are all the same in Christ, correct? So the charge is also to all of you to do the same thing with helping grow the church. When I talk so much about building this church, I don't just mean build this particular parish, I mean build Orthodoxy in America. Right? Talk with the people over at St. Paul's. Be friends with the people over at St. Paul's. You go and visit family members in other places. Like Luke, you're going home in a couple of months, right? Or a couple of weeks or whatever it is, right?
Yes.
Like work to build up the American Orthodoxy there and unify there and stuff like that. Right? That's the whole point. That's the whole idea. We should be one unified state. We're not there yet. We will be there. It's going to take everybody to do that. So, questions, comments, concerns. Oh, boy. All right, Benjamin first, then Anthony.
Okay, so...
And to this topic particularly.
Yes. So, for those of you who don't know, I'm originally from Sacramento, California. And when I was growing up, I had attended Fatherian Church over... because my family spoke Russian, and it was the closest thing to it. And then it was until I was 17 that I found Father Ian, and his Orthodox Church was in English. And it was the first time that I was able to understand. And there was no, the first time I came across where there was no distinguish of different nationalities, it was just Orthodox. So, okay, so my question would be is how do you get these different type of ethnicities, because they're very close niche communities, that how they would combine themselves with the practices of like Father Ian's church, which is basically open to everybody.
So your question is how do we get all the ethnicities to buy into this idea? Good question.
Because
That's the big question, right? How do we? Well, you know what? That's where the argument could be made that it'll take time, obviously. Okay? But if you, but I'll say this, the long story short answer to it is build a good community here, and others will imitate that. Imitation is key. If people come here, I spread that message of you're always welcome to every single person in this parish, right? Regardless of where they come from. Even though I make the silly jokes from time to time about that, really, I don't care where they come from, right? That's how you spread that. That's how you get people to realize that. Because isn't that what America did at the very beginning? Said everyone's welcome here? Now, of course, today we have a problem with that because people have taken it the wrong way, right? I'm not saying that. I'm not saying, oh, everyone's welcome, therefore everyone go take communion, right? But I am saying everybody here is welcome. Everybody to come in and receive who Christ is. That's the message that has to be spread. It has to be spread as churches need to see themselves. And it's happening throughout the country, right? There's a lot of Orthodox churches that are under the Greeks, under the Russians, under the Romanians, under the Antiochians, who have completely dropped putting that in front of their names when they're on their signs and on, when they tell people about their churches, right? The vast majority of seminarians now going to seminary are not ethnic Orthodox, okay? Our own Metropolitan is a convert. The bishop that I came from, I don't know if Archbishop Alexander is a convert or not, but the one I came from in the West, Archbishop Benjamin, convert. That doesn't mean that everyone has to be converts, right? But it means that, like, you know, I'm not a convert, but I'm solely, like to think of myself as solely American, you know, American first and Greek second kind of a thing, you know? That's where that has to come to. It has to be reminded that this is, we want that singular church that we have to make the communities welcome, and we have to send those people to that, right? Send those people to seminary that have that mindset, right? And I'll tell you, the vast majority of seminarians are going to St. Vladimir's and St. Tikhon's. Yes, some to Holy Cross, but, and they're coming out of it with that mindset. So it's happening. It's just, it's happening slower than Father Stephen would like, you know? So, did that answer your question? Okay, Anthony.
I've been blessed to lead Bible studies for Antiochian Church, for Greek churches, and for OCA. I originally found the first couple of years I was worried about, like, this bishop does this and this structure is there, and all that was kind of messing up my head. And then when I kept growing in Jesus prayer and kept moving my thoughts into my heart, and I said, how can I focus on my own salvation rather than worry about things that I cannot control? And Christ is the head of our church. And he will take care of this. Even if it takes 120 years, he'll take care of it. And I just need to focus on myself. So my question along this line is, how do we make sure that we pass that message on to the people that are listening to the podcast, people that come here and said, okay, we have some jurisdictional stuff to work out. Christ is the head. Enter your heart. Grow in Christ wherever you're at. And don't worry, you can walk into any Greek church, any Antiochian church, any Romanian church, Serbian church, and you can partake full communion. You're fully Orthodox. They're fully Orthodox. We're fully one in every way I can imagine. You can. I mean, so that oneness, how do we talk about that oneness that we have right now? There's a lot that we have in common, despite some of the jurisdictional, political challenges.
Well, again, it's sort of a case of why not both, to your earlier comment. I'm just trying to work on my salvation, my soul, such like that. But at the same time, I talked about this last week at the class, the rich fool thing, right? We have been given these. This is our, like, we built our barn, we filled our barn, we're very rich. But we can't squander that time because our soul is needed. This night our soul is needed. Our soul is still needed even when we are on our deathbed. We should still be trying to apply this idea that we grow, we unify the church. Sure, the jurisdictional things, they'll work itself out, right? But I always want to be careful with saying it'll work itself out 120 years, so I don't need... Like, I want to be careful not to say, oh, I'll let somebody else deal with that problem. Because you're right. Those bishops will deal with it at their own time when they decide to do that. Okay? But... they... we can't have the whole, well, if they're just going to work it out, then I won't worry about it. Right? Because sometimes, you know, you have to remind them, hey, you're not doing anything. You know? Like, think about, like, our government, right? When our government doesn't do what we want it to do, what do we say? We go online and we big hashtags, you know, or other things, right? We big stinks about it. We get online and we spew all of our thoughts on the matter, whether good or not. My point being is we let our voices be heard. I'm not calling that we let our voices be heard. I'm not saying everybody go email the bishops and tell them to get their act together, okay? That may have come to a day when we have to do that. However, I am saying, though, is that we formulate a good community here and grow a good community here and be a shining example of what that looks like, where everybody can come in that sense, and also say, because I tell people all the time, I say, look, if you want to go, if St. Paul's is closer to you on the Sunday, go to St. Paul's, right? If you are... if you don't like me and don't want to come here anymore, I don't want anyone to like me. I want them to just come for Christ. But if they said, I'm not going to come here anymore, I'm going to go to St. Paul's because I like that church better, fine. God bless you. You know? And things like that. As long as you're an Orthodox church, I'm happy. You know? Never been an issue with people going to other Orthodox churches as long as they're going to church. Right? But at the same time, we can't just sit back and say somebody else will do it for us. We have to, like, you help me with the studies. We do all this type of stuff. And I constantly preach this message of, we're doing all these extra things, right? Why? So that we can replace things in people's lives with good and holy things, right? You know, as much as, you know, sorry, Dan, to pick on you for a second, but as much as Dan loves the Georgia Bulldogs, right? I would hope and pray that if I said to Dan, hey, Dan, you're going to miss tonight's game so that you can, you know, help with this particular, you know, study that we're going to do or do this thing at church, I would hope and pray that Dan would say, yep, Father, whatever you need, let's do it. That's, again, I'm picking on Dan here, and I know he would do that, but I would hope that everybody would have that mindset and that we cultivate that in our community, that the church is the center of our lives, and that cultivates not just out here, but out into the world, right? That they see that, you know? Say Seraphim of Sarov, what's his famous line? You know, obtain inner peace and 1,000 around you will be saved.
Yes.
Well, guess what? Obtain a parish that shows the shining light of what Christ's church looks like, and 1,000 Orthodox churches will imitate that. We're imitation in that sense. You know, that's why it's so important that we go out there and we preach, whether we preach it in a sense, but also tell people, if you live the faith, they go, that's the church I want to be part of. That's the church I want to, you know? In other words, I want to say it like this, and I'll let my answer on this and say, you know, there's that joke that people say, not joke, but like that sort of snarl that you hear atheists say, and it's to make the joke of it, the Jordan meme where he says, I was offended by that, I took that personally meme, is when atheists say, I would follow your church if it wasn't for your people. I take that personally, which means that we got to make our people better, because that line should never be uttered. Right? That's the way I look at it as. Sure, definitely do it to yourself. Definitely make yourself, because you know what? That will lead to this. Right? So I say it more along the lines of, why not both? You know? The church, there's no excuse for us to, yeah, the jurisdictions will work themselves out. I know they'll work themselves out. It'll take time. You know? But also, I'm not going to sit back and just let them do it on their own time, because if I sit back and let them do it on their own time, they'll never do it. Honestly, I know. It's because that's the nature of humans, right? They will skate through things until they're actually faced with it. When this country faces a real crisis of faith, I'm not talking about like, oh, you know, there's somebody calling themselves a they, them. That's not a crisis of faith. Okay? We're talking about where they're putting Christians in prisons and trying to kill them. Then there's going to be a unity again. They will have a choice. Right? I don't want to have to do that, though. I want us to be unified before that. Okay? You know? Anyway.
Well, the main reason that I'm bringing that up, because I've heard some Protestants online, they try to give the false impression that Orthodox are not united, they're not one, because you have Serbian Orthodox, you have Bulgarian Orthodox, you have Greek Orthodox, and they're all against each other. And I'm like, what the heck are you talking about? We are one church, one Holy Catholic Church. We operate as one. I can go take communion in any of these churches. I can grow. I have the same faith in all these churches, same theology, same practice, same liturgy. I mean, everything is one in every way that I can imagine. And when I hear someone say that from the outside, I go, you have no clue what you're talking about, because you haven't experienced what I've experienced for the last 17 years. I've seen, yes, there are problems. When I go to the Greek church, where they speak a little more Greek. I go to the Arabic, they speak a little more Arabic. And the English might speak all English. But at the same time, that's Zoe. But at the same time, I've noticed that we have that oneness. And so I want to make sure that we do bring that to the theological reality and practical reality, that we are one church. Christ is our head. We have bishops. We have priests. And yet we have that oneness. And that is, in practice, there's a lot of oneness going on at the same time.
It's all marketing and branding. It's all marketing. We have to market ourselves better. I agree with you. Yeah. I mean, I told you. What did I say a second ago? I said, I don't care if someone, like, I get all the time, like a few weeks ago, Allison had a concert in downtown Savannah. So Ron texted me and said, sorry, Father, I won't be there this weekend, but we're going to go to St. Paul's. And I said, God bless you. Go for it. Right? Some people, not them, obviously, but some people will be like, is it okay? Are you sure? And I'm like, of course it is. Not them, obviously, but there are people who do it. I knew that, right? Like Father Anthony Carver, blessed memory, you know, used to tease me and say like things like, you know, he used to joke, because some priests will get really like, oh, my people only go to my church. I used to say, you can steal as many of my people as you want, as a joke, right? Because he's like, I've got people that are out in Payton near where you're at. They should go to your church. You know, that's the mindset I want to have. And Father Anthony had that mindset. And I want to imitate that mindset. So I tell people that all the time. Go to the, like, there was that guy, young man who came a few months ago who was in the military stationed in Beaufort. I said, go to St. James. Like, you know, of course you're always welcome here. But, you know, I joked with Felix. I said, his friend, his roommate, it's your roommate, right?
Yep.
I'm like, your roommate should be coming to church here. Not because I want to steal him, but because we're close. You know? And he goes to Beaufort. But if he finds a home in Beaufort, fine. You know, Father James shares the same mindset as I do, though, in that sense of everyone, it doesn't matter, you know, if they came to here, right? If Felix lived in Beaufort but came here, he'd be happy too, you know, kind of a thing. So
now, it would be a blessing to experience. Well, one thing that we had in Houston was, during the week, we had many divine liturgies for different saints' days and so forth. And I could drive 30 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour to experience that divine liturgy. If I had time, I could just dedicate that time and go. Whether it's Greek, whether it's Antiochian, Russian, it didn't matter. You just go. And it was wonderful. And it is still wonderful. And it's still there.
There are obviously, there are cities throughout the country where that's the case. Yes. You go all the way through the East Coast, the Northeast Coast, you can get that, mm-hmm. right? And sure, maybe there's an argument to be said that, hey, you know what, because the country's so spread out, that's why we don't have that everywhere. But to me, then the problem is just build more churches. And you have that problem solved, you know? Yes. Like, why don't we have 5,000 churches in this country when we have, like, 300,000, 400,000, 500,000. Why don't we have more than that?
Well, one reason is we asked the question in the beginning is those 12 priests have not come out of this church yet, or the 72 priests, or however the number is, or 67, is that so? Priests. I don't know what that means, honestly.
So. You don't want to.
Okay. So that will help.
Of course.
Yeah. And so that organic experience, now I will say personally, going to bringing visitors into the Greek church, bringing visitors into the Antiochian, we were able to help some of them make that journey into the church, but the language barrier would block many of them from coming back. And they would go visit a parish that was all English, and they would travel, literally we were like around the corner from this person, that person would travel 45 minutes to go to somewhere that was all English. And we tried so hard to make our liturgy all English, and then the folks that were comfortable in Arabic, they'd be like, no, we need to have Arabic, this is Arabic church. And we would have that, and the priest would be like, okay, I just gotta, you know, live with what I've got right now. And that was a challenge. So coming to an OCA church where everything is in English is easier, and it's easier to grow, and it's easier to bring people, they understand everything, they can follow everything. And the funny part is, just a side story, I visit one of the first Greek churches I visit, that one of the board members comes over, and I'm just visiting the first time, he goes, I'm so sorry that a lot of the church is in Greek. We're losing all our young people because it's in Greek. They don't understand what's going on. I'm so sorry. I apologize. I'm like, I'm just visiting your church. But that was his first thing. He was like, I'm so sorry we have so much Greek here, which was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, you're asking a question or making a comment, a very good comment, a very good comment that gets brought up. It's a comment that Bishop Billy and I talked about, which was, how do we solve that problem? You know, and, he basically said it's going to come from the top down, right? He was just saying, well, it's going to come from the bishops. The bishops have to get on board with it. And that was what he was working on trying to do. I mean, I would agree with him in that sense. I would say, though, it doesn't mean the people just wait, right? And I think the answer, again, comes back to my earlier comment, which is cultivate a good community and others will imitate. Right? When those Arab churches, and my mom and I have talked about this too, with her being, you know, Greek, but she was born and raised in Lebanon, and I was baptized in the Antiochian church, so I'm quite familiar with all the different jurisdictions in that sense, right? You know? And even Benjamin said this with his church growing up, right? You know, coming from that. You know, when they see other churches doing things, they're going to imitate those things because they can't. It's sort of like a good competition. Like, good competition's good, or competition's good for the best. Like, it's sort of the capitalist model of competition's good because it causes you to innovate, right? In the sense of it. You know, I said, well, if we grow like crazy, that's going to force St. Paul's to do the same thing because they're going to see us and see all their young people coming over here and all the Greeks going, where our church is dying and our food festival isn't going to survive any longer if people are leaving, right? So we have to start doing what they're doing. I think that's what's going to happen, is you just have to cultivate that there and the rest will follow, right? Going back to Colorado Springs for a second on this, right? So the Greek parish in Colorado Springs, right? When Father Anthony got there, he was at the OCA parish, but when he got there, you know, at Holy Theophany, it was like, it was some ethnic things there, but it was primarily an OCA parish, right? As he grew that church over the 20 plus years, 30 plus years he was there, right? Archangel Michael, the Greek Orthodox parish in Colorado Springs, it was like literally a few miles away, they went from being predominantly Greek to being half American and even switching a lot of their stuff primarily to English because they were losing their people over their converts and their Americans over to Holy Theophany, right? And it wasn't like Father Anthony was trying to compete with them, right? But it actually ended up helping both of those churches because that church, the Greek church there, started to grow again when they started to do that, right? When they started going, oh, we can't just live in the past, right? And I'm not saying I'm not telling us we have to be progressive in that sense, right? Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that those churches are, so, you know, to quote an old wiser priest and myself, or rather to modify an old quote, the God makes bad priests so the good ones will shine. Well, God allows bad things like that to happen to the churches so the other churches will shine and it will grow the other churches. And I think that's the mindset. They will imitate what we do. I think St. Paul's will see what we're doing and imitate it, you know? Like even Father Thomas said this to me the other day when I talked to him on the phone. He goes, oh, I heard you got a lot of catechumens making me have to work, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, yes, why aren't you? You are in a bigger area than I am, you know? I have to use the internet to get my people. You literally just have to put a sign and you should be getting people. Your door should be full. You know, you got all those college kids. Why aren't they walking in your church, you know? And stuff like that. Why do I brand us as Savannah Orthodox Church on our website? Because if I call this Rinkin Orthodox Church, nobody's going to come. You know, I know how search engines work. Okay, I'm very good at this, at that. I know how that works. If you go and put on there, I mean, I have landing pages specifically to ethnic groups so that they understand. And you know what? I even put on the Greek one. Go to the St. Paul's. If you need a Greek parish, go there. If you're welcome here, you're welcome at both as long as you go to church. Literally, the Greek page is the only one of those landing pages that does that. Yes. It tells them to go to that church. The other ones, they come to me, you know?
Are there any questions for him while he's here? We have Father teaching on a Sunday. Are there questions about this area that he's talking about? Have you seen something that has caused
your
heart?
Question. You wanted to ask. Not Jesse, Evan. Oh, I keep wanting to call you Jesse. I don't know why. Evan had a question.
People have called me Luke, Jesse, all this kind of stuff. I was going to add something. Like when you were talking about how Protestants talk about, oh, there's a lack of unity because of the different ethnic churches, right? Stuff like that. I was also saying, like, a lot of Catholics use that as an argument for the papacy.
Yes.
Like as like a unifying, mm-hmm. you know, principle and all that yes. kind of stuff, right? But again, I think, you know, like you said, it's a kind of... it might look kind of scattered now, but like when you're really into it, you see the unity. And yes. you see how the church is self-organizing itself, being led by Christ.
Mm-hmm. Well, to your point, not to turn this into an Orthodox versus Catholic argument.
And I'm not trying to do that.
No, I know. But to your point, right? Someone said to me this recently, saying, Father, what are you going to do when you have your 500 people in your church? You can't manage 500 people. And to Anthony's comment earlier, great, I'll send 12 guys to seminary. You know?
Yeah.
Like, why do we have Ron going into the DVP, even though we have a perfectly, you know, good deacon here? Although he's not here to defend himself, but, you know, neither one is. But, like, Deacon Vasily can obviously still do the job for the next few years at least. Right? He's obviously not getting younger, but he can still do the job to really, he's a good deacon. Okay? Why do I need a second deacon? Because we're growing, because I'm going to need a second deacon. Guess what? You know, I want to be like where we have like Father Marcus's parish. You know, he's got, you know, two full-time priests there and as assistants with him. And you know, he's a chancellor, so he needs that, right? But also, even he didn't, that church needs three priests full-time and two retired priests. I think two retired, at least one retired priest there, you know, something like that. I even took Father Michael last weekend. And stuff like that. Say, hey, we keep growing. I'm going to need you to come serve doing communion, right? We're going to need a third chalice. Well, guess what? You know how you solve that problem? We'll get more priests. You know, that's what, when Catholics say, well, you know, we need to set, I'm like, because you can't manage all those people. Well, you know what you can do is you can make more people within that. You know? Like, if the Catholics want to solve their problems, then they need to make like 5,000 bishops, because they have more than enough, you know, clergy to make bishops. They have more than enough so they can do that. You know, but then, you know, here's the thing about it is, right? And this is the problem the Antiochians and the Greeks have, right? They answer to four bishops, right? They've had really good bishops who have understood the situation in this country, right? But then they have ones who just don't have a clue what's going on over here, right? Because it is so ethnically different there than it is here, right? They had to react to that. What did the Catholics need to react to that? They made an American Pope. That's how they reacted to that. You think they wanted an American Pope to make Trump happy or any other president happy? No.
Yeah, yeah.
No, they understand the situation. Not only do they understand the situation, they said, hey, here's a guy who's from a country that's the central country of the planet. Right? Everything is imitated from America. The other countries of this planet might sit there and say, oh yeah, you know, we are this thing, we do these things, and you guys are wrong about all this kind of stuff. But you want to know something? I can go to any country on this planet and guess what language that those people will speak to me. They'll speak their own language, but they all know English too.
Yeah,
English. They know English because of our country, right? We are the powerhouse of the world. We are the, and none of us have to be rah-rah America, okay?
Yeah.
You know, that's not the case at all, right? But, you know, the Catholics understand that they can't survive. That's like what I said, showed you that thing yesterday, the AI thing with them, right? You know, you think they're posting that because they think, oh yeah, they understand the situation, right? Are they reacting to it the right way? Well, that's a conversation for another time, maybe, right? But at the bottom line of it is, right, the whole reason it failed to begin with the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church and the schism occurred was because the Catholic Church tried to embrace an ideology that just not cannot work, right? We are too many people with too vast a diversity when it comes to our understanding of the world, and we're too spread out that even with all the connections of today, right, and you could make the argument we're so connected today, right, that maybe that's not an argument to be made anymore. That's not true, right? Because we still have to. Until I can teleport to your house like that, we're still distant, okay? And the other thing about it is, too, is even if I can call you, I'm never fully getting a full conversation with you, right? We're having more of a face-to-face engagement than I will ever have with the internet. It's like what I told you about the internet, right? The internet, you can sit there and have a debate with somebody, but a full-blown one-on-one conversation with them will do wonders, right? Because at the human level we connect on that, it cannot be managed by one singular person. That's the whole thing. The only one who can singularly manage it is Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Okay? You know, Josh is not here because he's working at the fire station this weekend, said to me after he got baptized, he said, I finally get it when it comes to the whole idea of who Jesus is. I said, what do you mean? He goes, I get how powerful he actually is because I couldn't do what he does. I couldn't do, you know, I could not put myself on that cross, allow myself to be hung. Because he was listening to something on YouTube about, they were talking about the heresy, I can't remember the one, but did Christ really suffer, which heresy that was, right? And the reason is because he, is it Doetism, I think is the heresy, Anthony? Or did Christ really suffer on the cross? Because basically, the thing about it like this, right? Here's a sports analogy for you, Dan, for me. Okay, if I said to you, you're going to win the Stanley Cup this year, and I could go in the future and tell you you're going to win the Stanley Cup, your team's going to win the Stanley Cup, right? Like, are you going to be stressed out the rest of the season? If I said Georgia was going to win the national championship, would you be stressed the rest of the season? Would you be?
Like, you know it.
I know for 100% fact that they're going to win it.
I'm cool.
You're cool, right? That's the argument that they make, right? Did Jesus really suffer on the cross because he... he's God. Like, what? It's 5 hours of an uncomfortable afternoon? Easy peasy. You know? It sounds easy, right? You know, it sounds easy. 5 hours on the cross. 6 hours. 2 days. 3 days. Whatever the timer, right? You know? For an eternity? Like, really? Like, you know, I know it wasn't that. You know, like one of my professors at seminary, Dr. Peter Buttigieg, used to say that God could destroy the world and recreate it and 25 times in this conversation, you wouldn't even know it because you can't, you know, because it's so powerful, right? Yeah. So you mean to tell me that God couldn't just endure that and be good with it, right? But that's not how he operates, right? He really did suffer on that cross.
Yeah.
He really did put himself through that. He took everything about every part of creation and said, it needs to be fixed, and I'm going to do something that nobody wants to do. Because honestly speaking, even those who say, yeah, I have a problem with dying, even those who commit suicide, nobody actually ever really wants to die, right? We don't want to die. We, you know, like...
Well, the interesting thing, not to...
Okay, no, you're good.
Like, the interesting thing about suicide, and I don't want to get too deep into it because it's a rough subject, but like, the interesting thing about it is, in many ways, it's like, it's somebody trying to seek some kind of relief, some kind of life, away from the pain. Right, but it's weird in that it's still taking your own life.
Yeah,
it's almost like you're looking for a life without all the.
You want an easy way out.
Easy way out, right?
Yeah, you don't want to face your problems head on.
Yeah.
Where Jesus said, "I'm going to face my problems head on."
Yeah.
And Josh was saying, "I finally get it because Jesus was willing to do something that nobody else could ever do."
Yeah.
Right, and that's what I'm saying. Like, only one man is capable of doing that. Can actually face the problem head on, right? Because here's the thing about it, right? Our faith still requires us to say, we have to trust, right? Where God doesn't have to trust because he already knows he's God.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to trust that he's God. He knows he's God, right? We have to trust, even to our dying breath. You know, see guys, you can put every single miracle in front of the person, literally Jesus standing there going, I'm real, see, I'm real. And there's still a, like a 0.00000000001% chance that you doubt it.
Yeah.
Right? There's always a little bit of doubt. That's why, you know, there's not, like, St. Thomas, for example, doubting is a good thing. Because it reminds us that, hey, I have the prize. You're going to fall, but hey, I have the prize. So, anyway.
But you know, you also see God's wisdom in the way that he set up his church, the Orthodox Church. Because on the one hand, you have the Roman Catholics that would say, no, maybe we need to have this structure where we have a supreme pope and overrides everybody else. And guess what? Look at all the heresies they've had since then for 1,000 years. How many more heresies do they have to have? How many more transvestites do they have to open up their doors to? They have special rooms in the Vatican.
Or do processions with rainbow crosses.
Pedophiles they have to have as priests in it for the last 100 years. I mean, just all the problems that they've had, from practical speaking, horrible evil that's gone on inside the church, and also the theological changes that they've had in their structure. On the other hand, the Protestant structure has also had, and look at all the heresies of Protestantism has had for just in 400 years. So one or the other doesn't work, but the way God has set up his church, and the Orthodox Church, continues to work and protects us best.
So yes. So I want to make a comment here with regards to that, very clear comment about that. Because, of course, we have those same problems in the church, right? We've had heretics in our church, in Orthodoxy, right? I mean, how many councils did we have to have? We had 7 ecumenical councils, right? And how many of those did Rome participate in? They said delegates. The Pope was not a single council, right? You know? We've had to deal with heresies throughout the years. We've had to deal with...
Heretic Pope? We had to deal with...
Right? We've had to deal with lots of different people, right? The difference... And we have problems in our churches, too, with all those issues, right? We have bad priests, okay? We have... You
for
know,
those online, he raised his hand.
Yeah, you know, I'm the first among sinners. I'm the greatest among sinners. You know, we've had bad priests. We've had priests that have done very inappropriate things and have been just like that, right? We have, excuse me for saying this, pedophile priests too. Okay, I'm not raising my hand for that one because I'm definitely not that. Okay, but we've had that too, right? But here's the thing. I think you and I talked about this a while back. So I'm going to repeat it just for the sake of the recording and for those who haven't heard it before, right? You know, I have my views about a particular archbishop, not mine or the one, or Archbishop Benjamin, but one in the bishop in the Greek archdiocese, where I don't agree with some of the stuff he has said, okay? And he has said some stuff that's very questionable, and I go, how can you do that and still be a bishop, right? Especially some of the stuff that he has done and has been publicized, because every time I see something like that happen, and I go, great, someone's going to see that online, and they're never going to step into my front doors at the church. I know it, and it's true. I'm not, right? And I sit there, and I go, you know what? The difference between Orthodoxy and Catholicism in this sense, right? So many would argue, especially those who have come into our church, who have left the Catholic Church, like Dan, for example, would say Francis was a bad pope. Not the worst pope, but definitely a bad pope, okay? Right? He'll be remembered for centuries as a bad pope. Let's say he is a bad pope for the sake of argument. I think he was, but for the sake of those who may be ancient Orthodoxy who go, well, is he really? Give me more. I don't want to get into that. I'm not going to judge the man on what I don't know in his heart. But I will say, just for the sake of it, my opinion is I think he is. Okay? This other bishop that I said I have issues with, and again, I shouldn't be saying I have issues with the bishop, but it's more along the lines of the actions of what he does that hurts the growth of the church that I have a problem with.
Very unorthodox.
Right? In 100 years, how many people are going to know his name? Unless they make him a saint, which maybe he becomes a saint and I'm an idiot. You know? Maybe I should have just looked at him as an example. And maybe he was all right. Who knows? God, please change my heart if that's the case. But the Orthodox Church can survive 100 bad bishops. The Catholic Church cannot survive even one. Yes. That's the difference, right? You look at guys like, what's his name, James Martin or whatever it is, the guy who pushes all the gay stuff in the Catholic Church, right? The Catholic Church is not going to survive that if they allow him to keep doing what he's doing, okay? Because what he's doing is impacting their church for the next 100, 200, 300 years, right? If I went around on the pulpit and started preaching that you all better become Vegas Golden Knight Vikings fans, okay, or else, right? Good for me. Like, that might hurt this parish, and the parish might die in the sense of like people stop coming, right? But orthodoxy is not going to go away because I was saying dumb things, right? Like, you know, it won't go away. Whereas, you know, I joked again. I said, right, the thing I said this to Dan too, actually. I think I said this to you. I know I said it to you. Which was, I hope, like when the Anglicans announced their new female archbishop of the Church of England, I said, please keep doing that stuff. You know, do the crazy stuff because it's good for us, right? Like, you know, do that kind of stuff. It's good for us, right? You know, because those people will go away, but once they become Orthodox, then we can fix them, right? Why do I always say, oh, you're not Orthodox? I'll fix that. It's a joke, but it's really serious, right? You want them to come in, right? You know, you want, like, you know, you and I have talked about this. We've gone back and forth on this in good and productive ways, right? You know, this idea that we... you know, we could do all this kind of stuff, and what stuff will hit, some won't, right? Things like that. But our issues, any issues that we ever have as a parish, will work itself out over time. Just like this issue with the church, with the jurisdictions, will work itself over time, right? What they're doing in particular will not work itself over time, because it's one man who can literally tomorrow come up with a decree. You know, I always say to people when they go, especially my in-laws, drives them nuts. I say, you know, there's no difference between the Pope and the Mormon president. There's no difference. He can literally go into a room and come out and say, yep, new belief, you know, as the tides turn. And what has the Pope done throughout history? Tides have turned, cultures turned, let's do what they did. Imitation, let's do what they did. So anyway, I think we're good. I think we're done. Any other questions?
I have questions.
Can we do it after the recording? And I'll just, so we can pray and let people leave? All right, let's pray.